Evan, what's your favorite thing about Houston?
That food we had the last day.
Oh, God, the Cambodian, the beef pho kolache.
Yeah, that shit was insane.
Hello, and welcome to Expected Own Goals, Chopped and Screwed, Houston Dash Edition. I am your host, Eric Morgan.
I'm Evan Davis. Yes, it's part three of our NWSL Season Preview Week series. We are talking today with Theo Lloyd Hughes of Sports Illustrated and Squad Depth all about the Houston Dash and the interesting signings that they made in the offseason and whether that's going to make a damn bit of difference.
Do you think it's going to make a damn bit of difference?
It'll make a slight damn bit of difference, yeah.
I think that's about right.
Yeah.
Challenge Cup happened over the weekend. What are your quick thoughts?
Nothing. Washington was decimated by injuries. Orlando had to experiment with some lineup stuff because Oyan Hernandez's visa hasn't come through and Adriana's moved on. So they had to move a couple of jigsaw pieces around on the puzzle. So yeah, 1-1, a couple of fluky set piece goals. Beautiful set piece goals, but fluky all the same.
Mm-hmm.
Controversial officiating, a 0.07 to 0.06 XG per shot split, and then it went to penalties. That just about sums it up.
Yeah, this is the second year in a row that it really has felt as inconsequential as the Community Shield.
Guess because it is the Community Shield.
But like, props to Amazon. I thought the broadcast quality was incredible, and I'd love to see that for every single game.
Absolutely. Now let's talk about something very consequential. And go to our conversation about the Houston Dash with Mr. Theo Lloyd Hughes.
Love that transition. Here's Theo.
Boy, how to even summarize the schizoid nature of the team on the docket today? Well, there's nobody to do it better than the guy who works for The Athletic and for Sports Illustrated, Mr. Theo Lloyd Hughes, here to talk about the Houston Dash. Theo, how you doing?
Hello. Pleasure to be here. Such a huge XOG fan. You know, listener turned guest. Yeah, absolute pleasure to be here with you both. Obviously, such a huge fan of the show, and season is upon us. Strange time. It sort of feels like a big off season, and then suddenly you get here and you're a few weeks away, and you're like, oh my God, I'm not ready.
No one's had a more unexpectedly strange off season than the Dash. Before we get quite there, you, and I'm not here to put you on the spot, I'm not here to blow you up or anything, but last year, you predicted ninth place finish for the Dash. By basically every metric available to us, they were dead last in the table.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what happened, at least on the surface. Fran Alonso out unofficially at the end of June, officially by the end of the year. GM Alex Singer let go, and the team basically kind of sputtered through until they could cross the finish line in early November. In as much as you are able to discuss this in public, what the fuck happened?
Good question. I mean, there's always going to be, you know, a lot of journalistic standards and integrity to uphold when you talk about these kind of things. So I'm glad you said, what can you say? I feel like I've heard a lot of things, and not all those things may be true, so I won't be saying them on the pod. But I think what it comes down to is a culture of poor communication. I think something you hear on the record from what happened is just a sense of sort of people weren't communicating. And that's ownership, that's head coach, that's general manager. So Alex Singer, Fran, ownership, president Jess O'Neill, you know, all the way down to the players. I think there were serious communication issues with what the expectations were going to be, what promises, targets, what culture was going to be, like all these things. I think everyone you speak to kind of feels like they didn't quite get the right side of the story. And so when that happens, you then get people being disappointed and not mentioned in your departures, understandably, because those are the big names. But you've got to think about people like the Maria Sanchez saga, right? I think the stain that left on the kind of PR image of the club, especially because Alex Singer, who is a major player in all this kind of the culture of miscommunication, the club had worked so hard to publicize her contract and publicize her backing the Dash that when she feels like there's been a schism at the club that she cannot return from, that's when everyone starts going, okay, who is being promised what? Who is being told what? And I think that's why it comes down to miscommunication. Because if you have your biggest, most flagship player saying, I signed on to something that I'm not getting, then you've got problems all the way down the roster, all the way down with staff, front to back, like, you know, support staff, technical staff. I think you talk about getting over the finish line. I think assistant Ricky Clark had one of the toughest jobs you'll ever find in football, having to pick up that club off the mat without leadership, without a general manager. Technical director, Pablo Pinos Arce, he also departed. Not a lot of reason why he you know, arrived, immediately departed. He was an Alex Singer hire, did very well in Sweden, was very qualified for the job, but didn't really seem to have a role at the Dash that people knew what he was doing, or what he was doing wasn't communicated to other staff, other players. Didn't really seem to fit the model that Singer had hired him for, and thus the ownership were like, we're going to clean house. So all that is to say, I think if you're going to narrow it down, and obviously there's so many stories, I think we'll never really know the truth of Fran. For those that don't know, you know, the club put out the release about him being ill, and then he was not ill, and he recently, when he was hired for his new job in Spain, where, by the way, he's doing very well, he's taken Deportivo from the relegation zone into mid-table. He came out when he was asked by Spanish press about his illness. He said, I was never ill. So there's these kind of things, I think, have made the Dash, who are already had a very low kind of PR rating or very low reputation, have made them even stranger. But just to kind of, again, narrow it down, harbor it to something, it comes down to bad communication internally and externally. You know, the saying Fran has an illness when he doesn't, that's an external problem. But it speaks to a culture of internal poor communication. And yeah, they've tried to clean house, I guess. You get rid of your technical director, your GM, your head coach. There's some new assistant coaches as well. Ricky Clark, who did, like I said, did a very admirable job trying to get that team over the line. He's gone as well. So you really have almost a brand new club.
What engendered that culture of bad communication?
I think you have to point to the top. I think whether it is passive ownership or passive leadership from Ted Siegel and Jess O'Neill, like, I don't think it was like nasty. I don't think they were like, I don't think it's necessarily a culture of abuse, but it's a culture of sort of a little bit of sleep at the wheel, I think you could say. And so when you have the very top is asleep at the wheel, you know, the general manager then isn't being held accountable to certain decisions or again, communicating. If you don't have a general manager and a head coach to get on, you know, it's sort of like, well, where are you going to go from here? So then the head coach is then kind of going off the rails. So it's kind of like one thing leads to another, but I think it's really just a kind of a lack of attention from ownership and leadership. And I think it's important to note, as we head to the sort of 2025 part of this conversation, Angela Huchels-Mangano is not only the new GM, she is the new president of Houston Dash. And so before, Jess O'Neill was the president of the men's club and the women's club. So I think ownership and top front office brass have tried to address the sense that the Houston Dash need more attention in operations top to bottom.
What do you think made them pivot that way? Because I'll say, when we were at Media Day here in Los Angeles, Jane Campbell told us that the reason she signed her extension was because of Ted Siegel and Jess O'Neill. And you could hear a pin drop among the gathered press attesting to that fact, because it just would not have, knowing what little we know about the way that Siegel and O'Neill related to the Dash up to that point, you would not have assumed that a player would have recognized or attributed their passion for the club to that ownership group. And they've been there for almost 4 years. It'll be 4 years in June. So what motivated Siegel and O'Neill to maybe take the Dash a little bit more seriously within their remit, basically?
I mean, I think the 2024 season was so bad. And like I said, externally, the view of the club had got so bad from like a PR, like beyond looking at the table, because obviously in 2023, they didn't do great in the table. But Sam Leite is a very trusted guy in the league and everyone likes him. And all the players, when he left, said like, oh, you know, he was fine. He was good. We just didn't perform and he couldn't get the performance out of us. And that's football. You move on, right? You didn't have 2024 where it's a sense of like, everything about this club is messed up. And I think the club needed new leadership, like I said, from the very top. And Angela, I suppose, is going to almost be the one under the most amount of pressure to reset the culture, to reset the leadership model. And obviously, you know, your time with Jane in LA at the Media Day was so interesting, because within moments of that happening, Ted Siegel's emails every employee at the club and says, I'm exploring opportunities to sell shares in the Houston Dash.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think the two things are connected because Tezio's not necessarily looking to cash out. I think he could cash out. But what he's saying is, and you know, he's being very honest about this to some extent, is I bought this club for nothing, more or less. Now it's worth at least $110 million going off the Denver expansion fee. I could get $110 million of cash injection into this club, or at least maybe sell half the club or whatever. And that could help the Houston Dash build their own training facilities, or that could help the Houston Dash get a new marketing team or get more of their own COOs or CFOs or player coordinators or people that invest in scouting or recruitment. I think the Houston Dash is falling behind and has been falling behind in all these ways that other clubs are building out recruiting departments, data departments, player care departments. The Dash has always been the Dynamo Dash club, and so they've often shared resources when it comes to like marketing, branding, not so much on recruitment, but I think the recruitment side needs a lot of investment in Houston. So all that is to say, with the hire of Angela, who has now been given this new title of president of Houston Dash, and Ted actively saying we're looking potentially for buyers, either for the whole club or a share of the club, you've got to think that the Houston Dash is trying to level up. And part of that is cultural, and part of that is financial.
Do you think, because Angela Hiklis Mangano comes from an Angel City environment where she was the first ever GM to be deducted points for essentially screwing up salary reporting,
yeah,
salary cap violations. Do you think that she herself has something really big to prove here? Are you getting that sense?
I think so, but I also think, yes, she has something to prove in that she's kind of coming off being let go from a very big job in not just the NWSL, but world football, let's be real. Like, Angel City, huge club.
Absolutely.
Huge club. So I think she's definitely got something to prove, as, you know, she's a former athlete. She knows that when, you know, the club you run goes down the table, you want that new job, you want that new job to show that you can go back up the table, and that's what she'll want to do with Houston. But I also think there's a little bit of Houston feeling quite lucky to have her. Like, I think it's a little bit mutual. I think she's like, oh, I was able to land a big gig. I'm the president of this new club within days of getting sacked from Angel City. But at the same time, I almost think Houston's like, okay, we've got someone who knows what it's like to be right at the top of one of the biggest clubs in the world, especially in regards to some of these aspects of branding, club identity, taking care of your players, communication. Like, I think Hiklis Mangano's roster building could come into question, especially in terms of getting players in their peak. I think she's always scouted very well, very young, and she's taken care of veterans. But how you build 26 players throughout a season that's going to withstand injury and stuff like that is probably where you could criticize her. All that being said, she comes in with arguably more experience than Jess O'Neill and what it's like to run a football club, especially if Jess O'Neill is running the men's club at the same time. So it's an upgrade, is what I'm trying to say, even if you could point to points deductions, roster building, and be like, you know, Angela's not the most elite candidate out there, but she's pretty good, and she's probably worth a second chance. And in terms of building a culture and what a club might stand for, Angel City's further ahead than a lot of clubs, and maybe that's what the Dash need. They need someone to bring the club together and kind of build an identity, again, resolving inherent communication issues.
So it's interesting because it seemed like Houston was already making some pretty significant roster changes before Hiklis Mangano arrived. And
it's very complicated.
Right. And so, but it was very interesting to try and figure out, wow, these are some interesting and potentially ultimately good moves for the roster, but they don't have a permanent GM sporting director in place. Who's driving the car? Who is captaining the ship here? And is there actually a vision or a strategy in place behind these roster moves? What was the impression you got about the way that Houston's offseason was being run before Hiklis Mangano actually like got on the ground?
Yeah, for any listener that doesn't know, Hiklis Mangano was serving the suspension for breaking the roster reporting and salary cap rules. So she could not be a general manager or deal with transactions, be in charge of contracts in the NWSL until the 1st of January 2025. So she was essentially barred from the Houston books and deal making, even though she technically joined the club in December. She sort of had this weird period. Houston, when Alex Singer got sacked on the 28th of July, 2024, Houston hired former Orlando Pride general manager Eric Oostrakh as an interim general manager, basically because they were heading into free agency mid-season. They weren't going to hire a head coach. They wanted to hire a general manager sooner. You know, I was told in an interview with Jess O'Neill they'd have someone by September, October. Didn't happen. But they wanted to make sure Eric was there to essentially make sure free agents didn't leave the club, which is when, you know, Jane Campbell, you talk about, gets this big contract, Paige Nielsen, Natalie Jacobs, they sort of took care of the players who, to be fair, had played very well, had pledged their allegiance to Houston, were embraced by the community, really wanted a future at the club, wanted to be taken care of from a salary point of view. And Eric was sort of the guy to negotiate these deals. Because the general manager search went on so long, you then get Eric, you know, making a deal to bring in free agent Delaney Sheehan and sending, Eric sends $400,000 in allocation money to get Yasmin Ryan. And so suddenly Eric is not only making sure free agents are taken care of, which is sort of what he was first hired to do, was just evaluate who's getting a renewal. Suddenly he's playing football manager and he's sort of making these signings. So it was honestly extraordinary. And again, I actually think Eric did a very good job to some extent. And we can talk about more about the acquisitions being quite good. And I think people are like, oh, Houston had a good offseason. But I also think it really spoke to the sort of strangeness of things in Houston that you could have an interim general manager with no accountability, no long-term contract at the club making those decisions. Like, it is kind of wild that was allowed to happen from, again, from, this is what I'm saying, the ownership, Ted Siegel, Jess O'Neill. It's kind of wild they were just like, yeah, we'll just roll with Eric. I think Eric did a good job to some extent, but I am like, it's wild that was allowed to happen.
I think if you were to examine, like, in a narrative sense, the Houston Dash's year 2024, if you were making a TV show and you pitched these plot points, people would be like, this is a bit much. What's gone on? Like, you mean we're going to trade our... It's beyond the sports movie or the sports TV show sort of framework. Do you feel like the team is actually in a good position to have a more harmonious and maybe less narratively fascinating season ahead?
Yes, I would. I mean, I do think the team is better off with Angela, and we haven't really talked about him yet, but Fabrice Cadreau, the new head coach, and the players they signed. I think Delaney and Yaz are younger players, mid-career players who are really promising. You then add really, really veteran heads in someone like Danny Colaprico, who I think is sort of exactly what this team needed in terms of knowing how to play in the NWSL, albeit, you know, she's coming off another strange narrative-driven season in San Diego, so I'm sure she's got her own battle scars, and obviously a lot of battle scars from Chicago, but I think really good influence on the locker room. So I think the team is in a better place. I like the way you use the word harmony, because I think that would be the objective, right? Harmonize this group, harmonize the club, harmonize the fan base. I don't think everyone wants to win in this league. Everyone can win in this league. All these teams have talented players. But I do think the Houston Dash having a quiet, progressive, harmonious season would be a win. Let's be real. Like, starting from where they are, just kind of like the group sticking together. No one, the amount of trade requests they had last year. I mean, we haven't even really talked about the CeCe Kiser signing, right? The CeCe Kiser signing was probably one of the strangest things that ever happened at that club and the way she left. And Alex Singer wanting to make her like the biggest signing of last offseason, trading Nichelle Prince, who that really cut ties with a lot of fan base who love Nichelle Prince. And, you know, ends up with a manager in Fran Alonso, doesn't really know how to play CeCe Kiser, doesn't really want to play CeCe Kiser. So again, I think you look at moves like that versus this year, where there's a lot more joined up thinking, there's a lot more sort of locker room identities that I think are going to really fit people like Danny, people like Yaz. And you're like, okay, you know, just harmony. That's a good tagline for harmony in Houston. That's sort of the tagline for this year. That's really good, Eric.
Speaking of harmony, one of the people that's going to have to really shape that on the ground and in the locker room and on the training pitch is Fabrice Gautreau, who is the new head coach. Obviously, everybody knows that he is Morgan Gautreau's husband. He was
no way.
Sorry to break this to you, but the last name is not a coincidence. he was an assistant coach with Chicago. He was an assistant coach in North Carolina. This is his first top flight head coaching job. What do you make of that signing? How did that signing come together? What impressions have you gotten from him about the way he wants to do his job after coming off of what, I mean, you count all the interims and Ricky Clark, it's what, 11 head coaches in 4 years or some craziness like that? Like, what is Gautrot bringing to the table that might actually create some of the harmony that has been so sorely lacking at this club for so long?
I think a bit like Angela, you've got to look at it in the bigger picture of who wanted to come to Houston, or what did they, who could Houston attract, right? Like the Washington Spirit a year ago, go out and get arguably the best club coach, one of the best club coaches in the world, and say, okay, we'll let you finish at Barcelona, win a Champions League, and then you'll come over here. Houston Dash don't have that luxury. They're thinking, who wants this job? A lot of people we talk to probably aren't returning that phone call. And that's okay. That's what happens when you don't run your football club in a good way. And Houston's had to figure out who wanted the job. And I think, again, the head coach search, the general manager search, went on a lot longer than they would have thought, because I don't think the short list of people that wanted it was very long. Mm-hmm. And so to some extent, I think it says a lot about Fabrice that he was ready for a head coaching job, even if it wasn't the most ideal head coaching job, because he probably backed himself. And I think there is a quiet confidence about him. I think he is quite a quiet guy. From what we've seen so far, he's not used to being in the spotlight yet. And he's very used to a very systematic, well-run football club that does very well on the training pitch and likes to develop players in North Carolina Courage. So the Dash getting sort of a training ground guy, I guess not too dissimilar to Sam Laty, but I think it's going to be an interesting move. Although, like I said, I think if we can build the idea that Houston just needs harmony, and that a sort of Sam Laty-esque season of finishing 10th and being quite solid, if not playing particularly attractive football, I think that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for a head coach in their first year and for this club right now. But it does feel like there's just a lot unknown about Fabrice, because he hasn't been around very long. And North Carolina is such a well-set-up club, and Sean's been there so long, that it's hard to really deduce exactly what he brought. Albeit, if he can bring some of that grounded, process-driven football, I think there's a lot to like. And even talking to him the few times we've had, he's quite a serious sort of thinker in terms of talking about positional play and relationism. And you can tell he's got big ideas. I just am trying to sort of be like, we just don't know how many of those ideas are we going to see very soon, because you're building a club from this point. So I really think the jury's out. I think it was a hire that said, like I said, said more about who Houston was able to attract than Fabrice Gaudreau being sort of the number one candidate on the market. But I think they wanted someone who had, been at a club that's been consistently competitive in this league, loves being on the training ground, loves working with players, likes to talk very kind of nerdy football, wants to really work with systems. He's a systems guy. So it'll be interesting. I almost think, I'm worried that it's just if it doesn't stick immediately, will the vibes turn bad? But I'm kind of, my read is that I actually think he's going to be given enough time that I really think Angela and the ownership is going to give him at least a season. So if there's progress, right? If there's enough progress, then I don't think he's going to be under that much pressure. And that's kind of a cool position to see, because I don't think, maybe outside of Louisville, I don't think we've really seen coaches actually given that much time in the NWSL.
I think that's entirely fair. Do you get a sense, last year, one of my favorite sort of descriptions we've ever had on the pod, was when you described Fran Alonso as like playing guitar late into the night and having like an amateur graphic design background that he was pretty into.
Loved telling you about the things he was doing that weren't football.
Yeah. I was like, if there was ever like a sort of side post for like ADHD mania going on, it sounded like Fran Alonso had that. Do you get the sense dispositionally that Gautrot is like a complete 180?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that's probably what the club had to do, right? You had to go from like the slightly off the wall Spaniard that is going to be running up and down the touchline, celebrating every goal in a eventual 4-2 defeat, to, you know, the very serious school of Sean Nahas, who sort of has no sense of humor. Like, let's be real. Like, let's, you know.
Don't tell him that, but yeah.
No, I love, you know, Sean. We can say enough nice things about Sean. He's one of the best coaches in this league, and he's proven it year and year. You know, such a walls up, tunnel vision sort of guy who, even when you compliment one of his players, is like, make sure you mention the other 10 players. He's so team oriented, so system oriented, Sean. And I think Fabrice is meant to bring some of that. So yeah, to your point, I don't think it's a coincidence that they've flipped the switch in terms of personality.
Evan and I were talking before we went on this pod, and Evan loves putting together little tactics boards before the season starts. Do you have a sense of how this team's going to be laid out tactically?
We struggled. I mean, I made a kind of best guess at like a 4-2-3-1, but I'm looking at like 4 or 5 spots on the field that could be different players. I'm looking at this entire group that could be completely reshaped into a different kind of in possession formation. Like, what is Gotrek giving you guys, or what are you sensing is going to be his plans in terms of an 11 and in terms of a tactical approach, with the understanding that it could all go out the window by April?
Yeah, it's been hard. We've seen 2 preseason games, but because it's preseason, they have 32 players in the group right now. And in those games, we've seen 4 to 6 players at least who don't even have a contract who are currently getting minutes. So, you know, what does that tell you? And obviously, Jane and Yaz and Sarah with Austria, some of the internationals are away. So those are big holes that we haven't been able to see in the very brief preseason games. I think the 4-2-3-1 is a good shout. Again, like, if we're thinking we're going to see some of that North Carolina courage, I think fans will be burned from the Fran Alonso experience that, like, trying to immediately play possession football in Houston doesn't always end well. But obviously, I think the thing we can always say about football is, like, whatever you're trying to do, it can work if you do it well or you coach it well, right? Playing out from the back isn't inherently bad if you know how to play out from the back. So it'll be interesting in regards to, like, how much possession he wants, what that 4-2-3-1 looks like. I think the couple of things we've learned, or the consistencies, let's say, is probably Delaney Sheehan is going to be very important in that roaming 8, sort of maybe the connector who might start in the 2 but can push into the 3. Maggie Graham's getting a lot of minutes and seems to be highly involved as well, which is interesting because the team hasn't, as your brilliant piece and Equalizer said, Evan, team hasn't really gone hard on draft players or young players. They've kind of gone for more experienced players, and Maggie Graham is maybe the lone young player they've picked up, but I think she's going to be heavily involved. Messiah Bright, I think, has a great shout to be the starting number 9. Deanna Ordonez is still dealing with a bit of a shoulder issue. I mean, she hasn't really featured in preseason. So I think Bright could come straight in as the starting number 9, which would be interesting. Still maybe some speed issues on the wing outside of Michelle Alozier. But the big narrative as well is a lot of mums returning. Ryan Garice has been fantastic, scored against Thorns, playing left wing, looks quite good. And I think Katie Lind, such a huge, again, we talk about communication and culture. Katie Lind, since she arrived in 2020, has been arguably the most important player at this club, probably apart from Jane Campbell. Huge presence in the locker room. She was out last year because maternity leave. So if she comes back into the centre-back position, I think it really could turn things around again in terms of cohesion, in terms of group. Obviously, you've got Nat Jacobs, who could be kind of a floating right back, centre back. Paige Nielsen and her were sort of maybe some brighter sparks in a poor season last year. So we did see in the second half of the Wave preseason game, they went to 3 at the back and they had Katie Lind with Jacobs as a right sided centre back and Paige Nielsen as a left sided centre back and Katie Lind in between. So there is sort of like a flirtation with the 3 at the back system, which again, in Carolina, they could push those fullbacks high and you could kind of build in a 3 sometimes if one of the anchors, the number 6s drop in. So there's definitely they're playing with things, but it honestly feels too early to know what plan A is. It feels like they're just experimenting. But a bit like probably the only thing I called right on last year's pod was how important Avery Patterson was going to be. And I would say that just feels like it's going to be the same again. Whether it's 4 at the back and she's a fullback, or whether she's a wingback in a three system, she is sort of the key player. And she was last year, you know, she played almost every game. And I think they're going to really rely on her to be that glue between those first 2 lines, first 3 lines.
A lot of naturally right-sided wide players and not a lot of naturally left-sided wide players. So, you know, I pitched the idea of Alozia moving over to the left wing, Westfall moving from right back to left back. But those are
the Westville one could definitely happen.
Yeah, and this is what I was going to ask.
She played left back in the preseason.
Yeah, besides Amanda West, you know, all the players you would think could be in competition for a starting spot in a wide area, whether as a defender or an attacker, tend to be right-sided. So how do you find the balance? Even just going from your own personal subjective kind of gut reaction, what feels right to you about who moves left and potentially inverts?
Avery Patterson, I think, is another one. Okay. Barbara Olivieri actually has been playing left wing in the preseason as well. A player that deserves a mention because she was probably one of the few players, young players on this team who got better last year and really had nothing but amazing things to say about Ricky Clark and said her development, finished the season, I think, with 4 goals in 4 games. And there might have been an assist thrown in there as well. Finished the season strong, really sort of bulked up, also talked about the strength and conditioning team doing better. Last year, she felt like she was physically really strong, but she was playing as sort of a number 10 last year. She was getting a little bit more license to be a game winner. And it doesn't feel like Fabrice is going to do that, at least in these very, very early days. It feels like she might get pushed out wide and maybe is what you're talking about. If, let's say, you push Westphal or Patterson to the fullback position, are they going to overlap, which will allow Olivieri to come in despite maybe being deployed as a left winger or something? She comes in on a right foot and shoots. So there's something at play there. I do think Ryan Garice, who's a player, again, missed a lot of time last year because of maternity leave. She's coming back and looking really, really on it in preseason. She could be the left-sided option. But yeah, my overall feeling is I don't really know.
Yeah.
Like it just feels really early, and Fabrice slash the team just haven't really shared enough publicly, or what the clips we've seen, the 2 games that streamed on YouTube or AT&T Houston or whatever it was. Like, there just hasn't really been that much we can take away from them.
Maggie Graham, Amanda West, Sophie Schmitz, Sarah Punsigam, Yuki Nagasato, Katie Lynn, Barbara Olivieri, Ramona Bachman, Jalissa Harris, Alicia Chapman, you've mentioned a couple others that weren't even here. Like, there is so much group, you know, like this team had 15 players who started at least 10 games last year. No team had more than 15 in that scenario. And they brought basically everybody back. So I'm with you. I don't know how you make a determination at this stage from the outside who ends up being one of the 14 or 15 players you expect Gautreaux to rely on in the early going.
I was going to say, I think it speaks to the trust in Gautreaux in that they want to give him like a lot of clay. And a lot of these players that sat through last year and didn't love it are willing to give him a chance to be like, oh, I can prove myself under you. You're a new coach. It's a new year. And I think that's sort of the vibe. Again, especially that someone, like, I mean, Ryan Garice obviously had maternity leave, so she didn't even really play that much last year. But I think there is a freshness to some of these players coming back in and thinking, I can sort of reboot my career. The ultimate one would be Deanna Ordonez, who, like I said, did have shoulder surgery in the offseason, but, you know, everyone is like, can she be a player in Houston? She really hasn't hit her level. Even Michelle Lozier, actually, I think, is someone who her potential is higher than what we've seen. She could be even better than what we've seen. So I think even her coming in with a fresh sense of like, can I trust Fabrice to develop me more? I don't think we'll see Yuki and Ramona Bachman back. They're not currently with the team during preseason. I don't have anything to share there, but I don't think they're going to factor into 2025. I think Amanda West, who is left-footed, yeah, I think she is a really interesting player because she sort of played as a striker in college and sort of played as a striker in her rookie year in Houston, but could sort of play anywhere. I think Katie Lind will come back in and play a big role in the squad. Not sure, again, if they play 2 centre-backs or 3. Sophie Schmidt, I think, is interesting. Again, big culture, big leader piece. I think that would be, in general, you know, you mentioned Westphal. I think the fullbacks, there's a lot of question marks. I also think the second question mark is the center mid position because there's so many players. That's where they held on to players like Puntigam, like Schmidt, and they also recruited players like Sheehan, Maggie Graham, and who am I forgetting? Who's the third one? Danny Colaprico. So you've got this kind of stacked. You've almost got like 2 starting 11s in the 6-8. Kind of flex roles. So that's the position where it feels like it's a really open audition. And I also think players like Schmidt and Colaprico, who are towards the end of their career, are probably not going to be expected to play every minute. So maybe you can give Maggie half the starts and Danny half the starts and you're kind of like set. I think Sheehan's probably the exception where it feels early days like she is going to probably play every game.
I look at as the major source of like potential headache for Houston that they don't have a single player who played over 1,000 minutes that was a net positive passer of the ball.
Well, I think that's a good just interjection. Like creativity is almost a bigger issue. We talk about Diana, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not a striker that makes her own chances. So what do you need with a striker who doesn't make their own chances? You need someone who's going to set up chances. And they never had that. They lost Maria, which didn't help, but they haven't really consistently had good passes.
Yeah, they have a real challenge moving the ball up the field to even Yaz Ryan, who can be a very positive player when you get her on the dribble, but isn't necessarily a creator passing-wise for other players. Are there other headaches that you see in addition to ball progression up the field that you sort of have immediately flagged as like, this is a potential stumbling block for this Houston team?
I don't think Houston has had serious speed or physicality in the last couple seasons. I think that was one of the things that held them back under Leyte was very regimented and had some quite good system building ideas, but I don't think the players for 90 minutes, where there were so many games where they sort of would hang on or cling on and they wouldn't be able to quite fulfill the remit. And I think the physicality and lack of pressing ability, especially in the Houston summer, you need to be, and the team hasn't necessarily got younger, quicker, or fitter this offseason. So that would be my thing, is that I just feel like I look at this team and I'm like, how are they going to really win those one-on-ones or keep dueling for 90 minutes? And you lose, I don't think she was, you know, I've written about this. I don't think it was a bad idea to sell Tarciani, you know, someone we haven't talked about yet. I think they got a great price. You know, she was there for 8 months. Great. You banked on a very young, talented player. But Tarciani, when we did see her, could absolutely battle in the NWSL, and you do need to battle in the NWSL. And I do worry about whether it's Dani Colaprico not being able to go 90 minutes 20 times, or Maggie Graham having a welcome to the NWSL moment. Are you just going to have too many games where you lose that midfield battle, you lose those one-on-ones, or, you know, Puntigam is getting blazed by someone who's much quicker than her? I think that's where I would worry.
The question, and maybe it is literally what we've just discussed, the question that I like to ask everyone is to put yourself in the shoes of Fabrice Gautrat now. What is the thing keeping you up at night as you move into the regular season? What is the one sort of element that keeps you from sleep?
I don't think this team right now, from what we've seen, and a lot of this could fall on Yaz Ryan, but is ready to score enough goals or create enough goals. Like big chances, goal scorers, there aren't really either of those. Diana, at this point, we haven't seen it enough. Messiah Bright, we haven't seen it enough. So you're going into a season with your two best center forwards are kind of pretty unproven at this point, albeit with high ceilings. So, you know, Fabrice, the mic is yours. Show us how you can develop players. But I think you're asking Yaz Ryan to do a lot if she's expected to get 8 goals and 8 assists or 12 to 15 goal contributions. You can slice it up however you want. But I think that's what the team feels like they're banking on a little bit. And I would just, I'm really worried about goal scoring, because I think the back end of last year, Clark got them competing a lot more defensively, but they really were not scoring. And it's going to be interesting to see if Fabrice can actually get them scoring, because I think that's the only part of the team where you're just like, I don't know if they can. They're really going to need to hit on a player like Messiah Bright becoming a 10 goal a season scorer, 12 goal a season scorer, which I just don't know if that's going to happen in 2025. Maybe in 2026. This is why I'm saying big picture, less problems. If you're trying to win in 2025, maybe the lack of goals keeps you up at night.
Moment of truth. Where are they finishing in the table?
I'm going to go with 10th, which is sort of, I'm always stuck in that area. But I think I would be shocked if they finish bottom, just because I don't think we see that very much in the NWSL. I mean, I think we see more movement than what we have seen to some extent, like San Diego going from 1 to 10 or whatever. Like that's more like the NWSL we see. But I think I'm going to stick my neck out and say Houston is putting building blocks in place to be more competitive in this league. And maybe we don't see it in 2025, but maybe we see it in 2026. And Fabrice, over the course of the season, molds that clay, discovers the 11 he likes, and kind of goes from there. So I'll say 10.
I think I am. I think I'm 12th for Houston. I was impressed that somehow, even though they were operating without a head, managed to like get NWSL quality starting players into their roster and got a few of them and seemed like they were willing to spend money to get them. And Gautrot is this beautiful tabula rasa on which we could write potentially anything. And it could be good, could be bad. But to your point, I don't know where the goals come from right now. And I also don't know where you get athletic defenders who can go minute one to minute 90 for 26 games. Yeah. So I just don't know how they can, they'll have enough gas in the tank to make it above 12th place. So Eric, what about you?
I have them, and I say this with a lot of admiration for the offseason that they've had. That Tarciana is an incredible sale and incredible value for that player. Would they benefit from probably having her this season? Yeah, but that's not the timeline. And so many of these things are about, despite having signed their two best offseason signings being two of the marquee players that were potentially available in Delaney Sheehan, and then subsequently, though I don't think we realized it, Yaz Ryan, I don't think those two players move the needle enough against the tide of not necessarily upper-level talent. But they have a lot of interesting characters for breakout. All of that said, 13th. it's a team that has enough interesting components that I don't know how they work together that it wouldn't surprise me if they actually finished closer to 10th or 9th. Like they're just enough functional pieces, but given the track records of everyone on this roster and a new coach, yeah, this is a big ask.
The team with the most unknowns, I think, going forward.
And who knows, maybe by the time the season starts, there have been a couple other things that have happened that answer this for us. But I am not banking on that.
You can find Theo on social media at Theo Lloyd Hughes and all of his writing at Sports Illustrated. And are we still doing the podcast, Theo? Is Squad Depth still up and running?
Squad Depth, yeah. I've been very busy, which is my own fault. But I want to get back to it, do more. But I've just been kind of spreading myself very thin. But yeah.
At the very least, on your podcatcher of choice, follow Squad Depth so you get new episodes in your feed when they come. Theo Lloyd Hughes, always a pleasure.
Great to be here. Thanks so much, guys.
I always end conversations with Theo feeling, I don't know, just the world's a little more sparkly.
Agreed. And his mustache is back, which it wasn't last year. So
it's true.
All's right with my world. In the meantime, please be sure to rate, review, subscribe, rate us 5 stars if you're going to rate us at all. If you are not a member of our Patreon yet, $6 a month and $60 a year gets you access to our Discord server for bonus episodes every single month, as well as access to our semi-regular YouTube live streams. Follow us on social media at XOwnGoals. That's the letter XOwnGoals. And if you believe we've made an own goal, please email us at expectedowngoals@gmail.com. That's the letter expectedowngoals@gmail.com. Season preview week rolling right along. Two more episodes today with the Seattle Reign and the San Diego Wave. So keep an eye out in your feed for those.
Bye.